For many Iraqis, the moment of support for the resistance came in April, when the U.S. military invaded Fallujah, a Sunni city of 200,000 on the banks of the Euphrates River, west of Baghdad. For 25 days, the United States Marine Corps bombarded the city, killing at least 600 civilians, wounding thousands, and turning tens of thousands of Fallujans into refugees in their own country.
Ahmed, Safi, أصغر من عندي. كان واقف الحائط مال المتوسط ده يعبر.
Ahmed was in my class. He was younger than me. He was standing next to the wall of the secondary school. He was trying to cross the road and he was hit by a bullet. The American troops fired the bullet. Americans shoot us on the street. They even bombed our school. We are innocent kids. We can't play on the streets because of the Americans.
Aaron Glantz began working at KPFA, Pacifica Radio's Berkeley station, when he was 19.
Everything that I know about being a journalist, I learned, you know, in community radio. And I learned it from the news directors at KPFA, you know, who trained me, and from my peers. First, my peers, the other volunteer reporters at KPFA and the staff reporter there, and then from other reporters that I met through producing Free Speech Radio News. And I was able to produce the national news, and got to meet all these cool reporters because we organized it as a collective. So I was always talking to people in like India and France and the Middle East and South America, and I was like, oh, these people are really cool. I can do what they're doing. I don't need to like be just like here in Northern California. I can go to the ground in these situations. I can see the world and get paid for it. So that's what I did.
Aaron Glantz covered the Middle East for Pacifica during the American invasion of Iraq, and started reporting from Iraq when Saddam Hussein's regime fell. He's been to Iraq 3 times and has just released a book, How America Lost Iraq, about his experiences. Circle A Radio interviewed Aaron Glantz about his experiences on the ground as a war reporter. We began by asking about the first time he entered Iraq.
We went to Al-Mahatta, the bus station on the outskirts of Amman, Jordan, my friend Raphael Kraft and I, and we got a taxi, you know, to take us into Baghdad, and it was a mid-70s checkered orange and white taxi. We found him, actually, because we were looking for a man we didn't know how to say in Arabic, we want an experienced driver, but we did know how to say we want a man with a big beard. So we actually requested a driver with a lot of facial hair, because the first one that proposed to go with us was a young man, and we were concerned about going into this, you know, very violent area with somebody without that much experience. So, you know, at the bus depot, he was produced then because he had a full beard, and he seemed like he had a lot of experience. He had good tires on his car, so we went with him. And we passed the border with very little event. There was at the border, there were a few American soldiers on the Iraqi side of the border, which was rather upsetting because it was the first like Americans that I had seen in months who weren't, you know, like I hadn't seen like an American police officer in like a year, and here they were like in like, you know, at the border between two Arab countries. But overall, you know, there was not a lot of heavy-handed presence of the Americans. You know, we saw them. There was another American soldier that we saw who actually pointed a gun at me when we got to Baghdad. But overall, you know, there was not this kind of, like, hyper-military presence that you see now. And there was kind of a positive interaction between a lot of local people and the Americans' soldiers. And a lot of the images that you saw on TV here, you know, American soldiers lighting up for ice cream with Iraqi civilians, you know, Iraqi children giving flowers to American soldiers, those did happen. I did see that, you know, a lot. And, you know, it was a... It's a big challenge to a community radio journalist, you know, coming from an anti-war perspective, to see that people were so beaten down by Saddam that anything that would have gotten rid of him was to some extent welcomed. I remember I heard this story from this communist writer, you know, and he had very few teeth. He had been through it all. You know, of course, Saddam Hussein executed the leadership of the Iraqi Communist Party live on national television in the early 80s. And he said, you know, we can deal with the devil, meaning America, but not Saddam Hussein. And there was, you know, even the people who were absolutely opposed to the Americans and their plans kind of had this attitude that, like, well, you know, we'll be able to take care of them eventually if they try to do bad things. And, you know, I went door to door, you know, in Karada, which is a middle class, ethnically diverse neighborhood of downtown Baghdad. And I walked through this building. I mean, it had no electricity because the whole city had no electricity at that time. And still to this day, there's only about 3 hours of electricity in Baghdad every day. We use a cigarette lighter to light our way up the stairs, and when we got to the top of the stairs, the first family that let us into their apartment told us that they planned to name their next child after George Bush, even though they had no electricity, no running water, and were currently out of work because of the security situation still. And people said this because they believed that their current situation would be temporary. And I think as it's proved that that's not temporary, people are increasingly are moving towards other kinds of tactics. I got to Iraq on April 28th or 29th, 2003, on May 1st, 2003, which is the day that George Bush landed on the USS Abraham Lincoln across off the coast of San Diego and declared mission accomplished. On that day, I was in Fallujah, unembedded, and Fallujah was a place to be because on the day that I arrived in Baghdad, the Americans had killed the first civilians of the occupation. There had been a demonstration against the U.S. military taking over a school and turning it into a military base in Fallujah. The people of Fallujah protested this, and the American soldiers in Fallujah fired into the crowd, killing 12 people. Then, when the funerals happened a few days later, there was also a demonstration. The American soldiers again fired into that crowd and killed more innocent civilians, and no American soldiers were hurt in either of these incidents. So when I went to Fallujah on May 1st, 2003, to try to figure out what was going on, I expected there to be a very large demonstration because that was a Friday. And I expected the preachers in Fallujah to tell the people to go out to protest, and there would be a gigantic protest, and there would be a huge confrontation that might end in blood. And so I thought it was important to be there. But instead, you know, after I walked through the vegetable market and the chicken market and the gun market, the preacher in Fallujah, the most pro-Saddam preacher, was telling people not to protest, that Islam is a religion of peace, and he had been negotiating with the Americans, and he told them that. So there was no violence. That was the situation at that time. I think people here, you know, they were watching the images on Fox and the very jingoistic coverage that we were getting in the mainstream media here, and they were looking for something to specifically counter that, to say, okay, Fox is telling you one thing, well, the truth is the exact opposite of that. But that, in fact, was not exactly the case, and I was finding that the big important stories of that time were not the human rights abuses of the Americans, because, in fact, during the bombing campaign, the U.S. military had actually done a reasonably good job of only bombing quote-unquote regime targets, as Donald Rumsfeld had said, although, you know, there were a lot of innocent civilians killed as well, but that they were targeting, you know, ministries, military bases, and the Iraqi army. So I found that the big story was like the 20,000 bodies that were being pulled out of the ground in Babylon that had been killed by Saddam Hussein after George Bush Sr. told the Iraqi people to rise up and then allowed Saddam Hussein to slaughter them in 1991, the full accounting of all of his atrocities and the reuniting of Iraqi people with at least the bodies of their loved ones who had been killed.
A few days after George Bush declared the U.S. military had succeeded in toppling Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, an American military Caterpillar vehicle fills the newly excavated mass grave next to a wheat field just outside the Iraqi town of Hilla, an hour and a half's drive south of Baghdad. For almost a month after Saddam put down a Shiite rebellion in 1991, busloads of prisoners were taken to this field three times a day. Tens of thousands of skeletons have been pulled from the ground, many of them bound and blindfolded. Now, with Saddam Hussein removed from power, Shiites are coming from all over Iraq, sifting through the dried bones, hoping to find their loved ones. Thousands of bodies have been claimed, but not everyone was able to find their family. This man was looking for his son Laith and his wife's brother Haider Ibrahim. He had nothing but kind words for America's current president. Like many Iraqis, he directs his anger towards George Bush Sr. At the end of the 1991 Gulf War, the elder Bush called on the Iraqi people to rise up and promised American support for their revolution. But when the people of Iraq rebelled, the American president withdrew his support and allowed Saddam to engage in a mass slaughter of the Shiites of southern Iraq.
The first Bush is the reason of this mass grave and what happened for all Iraqi people from 1991 until now. Because if they finished Saddam in 1991, nothing would have happened and we would have been safe.
But a year later, Shanam Abu Jaber, like most Iraqi people, has changed his mind about the occupation of his country. Many of his relatives have joined the resistance. Some have been arrested and are being held at the now notorious Abu Ghraib prison.
It's the same struggle as under Saddam's regime. Now it's been rebuilt by the Americans themselves.
He says a year after the beginning of the American occupation, the U.S. military has proven to be a harsh military overlord. He's also upset at the lack of electricity, employment, and clean water, all of which were in greater supply under Saddam's regime.
The military mind of the Americans didn't know how to deal with the resistance. They didn't know how to control them or to make them on their side, because it's not just a matter to have a gun and fight. It's a matter of our thoughts. We will join the resistance by our thoughts for all the people who are unable to fight. The women, the children, and young men didn't want to fight, but they are against the Americans because of the way the Americans behave toward the resistance, how they go against the resistance.
People were already complaining. They were saying thank you to the Americans for getting rid of Saddam, but they were already complaining that the Americans were refusing to negotiate an end to the occupation and working with the Islamist political parties that had sponsored the revolt that Saddam had slaughtered the people in, you know. And later on, we saw America go to war with Muqtada Sadr's movement, you know, the Shiite fundamentalist movement. Well, it just so happens that Muqtada Sadr's family is like one of the big important families that had been battling with Saddam all those years that America was supporting Saddam. I interviewed a man outside this Free Prisoners Committee who was a member of the Dawa Party, which has now come to power in the election. And, you know, Hizbul Dawa, the Dawa Party in Arabic, it's like the party of Islamic proselytization, right? And Saddam had brutally slaughtered the Dawa Party leadership and all of the followers of the Dawa Party in 1979, 80, 81, 82, before they went into exile in Iran. And here was this guy, I was interviewing him, and he was finally finding out that his brothers had been killed during that time by Saddam's regime. And he was saying, we are so thankful that Saddam is gone, but we know that America did not free us from Saddam. It was God who freed us from Saddam. And we don't like invasion and we don't like occupation. And if the Americans have come as invaders and occupiers, then we will eventually have to fight them. And so I think that, like, the job of the community radio reporter is to go to as many different types of people as possible and listen. It was a big conundrum, actually, in the early occupation period, because Saddam Hussein had really put a lid on communities, you know. So it wasn't like, as a journalist working in San Francisco, there are community groups with community organizations, and if you want to cover different communities, those communities have leaders that are easily identifiable. There are independent trade unions that you can go to if you want to talk to workers. You know, there are business groups. There are, you know, environmental groups. Like, none of that was existing in Iraq because of the dictatorship. And so it was very difficult. And I was just doing the best I can. And that's actually why eventually I broke down and just decided to go door to door in economically and ethnically diverse neighborhoods and talk to as many people as I could kind of randomly. But as time would go on, you know, there came to be kind of more structure to Iraqi society. You could go talk to political parties. And you could go, as I got to know more about Iraq, you know, I would go to certain neighborhoods to make sure that I would get certain perspectives where certain communities were stronger in those neighborhoods. So I would go to Adamiya, which is a very Sunni neighborhood, which is the last place that Saddam Hussein was seen before he was found in a hole in the ground outside of Crete. And I interviewed an auto mechanic who was part of the resistance, you know. And I would go to Mustansuriya, which is like a middle-class Sunni neighborhood, and interview people there who had been rounded up by the Americans, and go to Sadr City. And, you know, by doing this kind of work, going to different places, talking to friends of friends, you know, but making sure to have lots of different types of friends so that you have diversity in the friends that you interview. Because I don't speak Arabic well enough to work as a journalist, I had to work with translators. I tried to work with lots of different translators, even though I had, like, one person that I worked with most of the time. I was aware of the fact that, you know, he had his certain perspective. And so, you know, when I would go to Fallujah, I would go with somebody different. When I would go to Najaf, I would go with somebody different. I think that things kind of naturally happened over time. You know, you make relationships the more time you stay somewhere. The situation's so unsafe, people are a little more circumspect. But earlier, people, you know, very, very interested in helping to get stories out. Although now, one of the reasons that I'm not going back to Iraq is it's really unsafe to be a translator working with a foreign journalist. One of the people that I worked with has fled Iraq. Another person that I've worked with is dead. And actually, when I was talking to this former colleague of mine who fled Iraq, he was telling me all the people that I know who are dead now. Most of them were killed by the resistance. But the fact remains that more people, you know, far more people have been killed by the Americans than by the resistance. I've been to Iraq 3 times. I was there immediately after the fall of Saddam Hussein for about a month. I was there for 3 months during the spring of 2004, and I was there for 2 months during this most recent elections in January and February of 2005. And I've been to enough places to see, like, in the photos, like, about dogs being put in his cell, about not being able to sleep because the Americans kept throwing pebbles at him during the night, about being kept as a 15-year-old boy in a small room, you know, by himself for days on end. I mean, but the fact that these pictures came out explicitly showing what everyone knew at the same time, that the U.S. was bombing Fallujah, at the same time that the U.S. was attacking the movement of Muqtada Sadr, that was a key moment. And I think, you know, in the thesis of the book, How America Lost Iraq, is that it was then, in April of 2004, that America lost Iraq.
There is no God but God, and America is the enemy of God, hundreds of families chant at the gates of Abu Ghraib, once Saddam Hussein's most notorious prison. Now it's where the American army incarcerates people for supporting the resistance. The prison has become the center of scandal, with new photographs of severe torture released almost daily. One photo, obtained by the New Yorker magazine, shows a dead inmate wrapped in cellophane and packed in ice. Another photograph shows an empty room at the Abu Ghraib prison, splattered with blood. Standing in front of the cyclone razor wire fencing that circles the prison, Tariq explains his brother is behind bars along with his 73-year-old father. Both have been imprisoned for opposing the occupation. As under the reign of Saddam Hussein, scores of Iraqis huddle outside the gates of the prison, hoping for a chance to see their loved ones. Few of the families waiting outside Abu Ghraib have been granted a visit, and many of those with loved ones in American custody have not even been told where their family members are being held. Zahara Ibn Ali's 26-year-old son was arrested by the U.S. military a year ago in a raid that also destroyed her house. She's heard rumors that American troops killed him, but she hasn't yet given up hope.
I've been to every prison in Iraq, in Tikrit, Nasiriya, Umm Qasr, Balad, Basra. Whenever anyone tells me a place, I will go there. I have sold everything, and I am even ready to sell my pots, because I don't have any money to go anywhere anymore. It's not a problem if they just give me the dead body of my son. If he's alive, they have to let me see him. And if he's dead, they have to bring me his body.
Who was being taken to Abu Ghraib?
Everyone. You see it this week, the news that Mohsen Abdelhamid has been arrested. Mohsen Abdelhamid is a very important Iraqi politician. He was appointed to the governing council by the U.S. military. He is widely respected by the Iraqi people. He helped negotiate an end to the first bombing of Fallujah. He's from Kirkuk in northern Iraq, where the oil is, where the Kurds and the Arabs are living side by side and possibly fighting each other. He is trying to pacify that situation. People like him and people respect him, and he was arrested. And he was not arrested, I believe, on purpose. I believe that the Americans made a mistake. So then you have to ask yourself, if the Americans are making a mistake arresting a prominent politician, imagine how many other people they're arresting. The International Red Cross, as the Abu Ghraib prison scandal was going out of control last year in 2004, they released a report saying 90% of people arrested by the American army in Iraq are arrested by mistake. And that goes exactly with all the stories that I've heard. I interviewed an auto mechanic in Mustansuria, this, you know, middle-class neighborhood where Mustansuria University is in Baghdad, and you know, he was telling me about how he had been arrested twice by the U.S. military and taken to just the local military base there and hooded and, you know, beaten and screamed at for a few days until they realized that he wasn't the person they were looking for and they released him. I mean, almost everyone has had this kind of experience. And that's the same experience that happened to Mohsen Abdelhamid this week. The U.S. military admits now that they're holding 11,000 people in Abu Ghraib. Now, a year ago, when the scandal broke, the Iraqi Minister of Human Rights, who has since resigned in protest, told me that 11,000 people were being held in Abu Ghraib. And at that time, the Pentagon was admitting to only 3,000. So if the Pentagon is now saying that there are 11,000 people there, my best guess would be it's a very conservative estimate on their part. And also, this is just one of many cases. This head of the Sadr office in Hilla, near Babylon, who was arrested at a meeting at a human rights office in April of 2004, and I've been following his case, and he is still in prison. He was finally charged after a number of months with murder by the Americans, although they haven't said who he murdered or when he murdered them. And he is no longer being held in Abu Ghraib, but he's now being held in Basra, which is even farther from his family than Abu Ghraib. This is the situation. It's a long way from when the American soldiers used to line up with Iraqis for ice cream. Now you have a situation where if an American Humvee breaks down, they close the street. There was a situation just last week when an American tank broke down on the highway in Baghdad, the main highway going through Baghdad, and they closed the highway, the whole highway. It would be like, you know, if something broke down on I-5 coming through Portland and they just decided that nobody could go northbound on I-5 anymore. The whole freeway would be closed. That happens all the time in Iraq. I mean, there was this one time when I was trying to go meet the Minister of Human Rights, and his office was just across the Tigris River from where I was staying. The bridge, though, that connected where I was closed because that was a bridge into the Green Zone. And so that was permanently for American troops only. But then on this particular day, there had been an accident involving two American Humvees on another bridge. And after driving around in heavy traffic for 2 hours, we just gave up and went back home because we knew we wouldn't be able to make it to our meeting. I was talking to a computer scientist in Baghdad last week. He told me that he left for work at 5:30 in the morning. His work is 3 miles from his house. He arrived at 9:30 in the morning. It took him 4 hours to go 3 miles because the Americans have set up so many checkpoints in Baghdad. And I can remember going to Iraq in May of 2003. I can remember the fact that there were no checkpoints. And I was arguing with kind of like some more anti-war folks, more anti-war than me. They were saying, well, it's just like the occupation of Palestine by the Israeli military. And I would say, no, it's not. Look, I just went all the way from the Jordanian border to Baghdad, and I didn't go through one checkpoint. You know, 14 hours in a car, no checkpoints. That's not occupation. And I said, the Americans must be smart enough to know that the Iraqi people don't want to look like Palestinians on television, you know, and the moment that they perceive that their situation is similar to the Palestinians is from what they know from watching Arab satellite television, then the U.S. military will have lost. But that's exactly what the Americans ended up doing, is exactly the way the Israelis behave in the West Bank. Being there during the elections, being in northern Iraq, but also, you know, kind of monitoring the situation in Baghdad, there was a sense that things were going to perhaps get better after the elections because people went out to vote. And for the first time in 80 years of the Iraqi state, they picked the government that they wanted, you know. And, you know, there was a boycott by most Sunnis, which is about 20%. But still, voter turnout was over 50%. It was better voter turnout than it is in the most recent presidential election between Bush and Kerry. And Ibrahim al-Jafari has become the prime minister, and he's somebody who's widely respected. He negotiated an end to the fighting in Najaf, along with Ayatollah Sistani. And Jalal Talabani, the new president, is a widely respected Kurdish leader. You know, there were problems in Kirkuk, the ethnically mixed city where a lot of the oil is. The Arabs boycotted the election because they accused the Kurds of stealing the election, and there are potential major problems in Kirkuk as the Kurds try to include that in Kurdistan. Here's the main problem, though, that's happening now. When the Shiite political parties that won the election, when they were on the campaign trail, one of their major campaign pledges was to end the occupation within 9 months to a year. People voted for them in part because they saw it as a chance to restore sovereignty. But when you have these raids and these new U.S. military operations, Operation Squeeze Play, where they've rounded up 400 people, like Operation Lightning Bolt, which they're doing now, arresting even more people in Baghdad, this bombing of Al-Qaim in the northwest of Iraq near the Syrian border, where the sheikhs who control Al-Qaim and told the Americans that there were foreign terrorists in their midst, then ended up having their whole villages being destroyed by U.S. bombers just in the last month. All of this indicates that the new Iraqi government is not going to be able to deliver on its campaign pledges. And what that means is that the government will become delegitimized and the situation will deteriorate to a situation where it's even worse than it is now. I mean, people ask me, Aaron, what if we leave? What will happen then? Will there be civil war? And I say, maybe. It's possible. It's possible that we have now screwed up Iraq so much that there will be a civil war if we leave. But the longer we stay, the more people we kill, the more people we detain and take to prison, the more crap the Iraqi people will have to sort out after we leave, and the worse it will be. And the U.S. military can take some immediate steps. They can turn control of the Iraqi army over to the Iraqi Defense Ministry, for example. But right now, the Iraqi army reports to the U.S. Army. So you have the Iraqi army affiliated with these very unpopular carpet bombings, arrest missions. You know, the Iraqi police similarly are affiliated with the occupation. any sovereignty that can be given to this new government, I think, is a good thing, but it's not happening.
You're tuned into Circle A Radio. You've been listening to an interview with Aaron Glantz, Pacifica's free speech radio news correspondent and author of How America Lost Iraq. Stay tuned for more of this interview on Circle A Radio.
I don't know what they're thinking at this point. First, they thought they were going to be able to turn it over to Ahmet Shalabi, but everyone in Iraq hated Ahmet Shalabi. Everyone knew that he had to be smuggled out of Jordan in a trunk of a car because he stole vast amounts of money from the banking system of Jordan. Everyone knew that. So then they switched to Iyad Alawi, a former CIA agent and Ba'athist, and everyone saw him as a puppet of the Americans, too. So finally, they went to an election. They had resisted elections. They had hired a company out of North Carolina called RTI, and their slogan was "Selections, not elections." That was their slogan. And they went in and they picked the city council in all kinds of areas in Iraq, and there were protests, mass protests, repeatedly for legitimate elections in Iraq. Some elections were organized by the movement of Muqtada Sadr. And I think that that's one of the main reasons why he was attacked by the U.S. military. And Paul Bremer said he's a danger because he's not respecting the Iraqi government. He's building his own parallel structure. And Paul Bremer was exactly right. He was building his own parallel structure. Paul Bremer was the U.S. Administrator in Iraq until he left in the middle of the night on June 28th, 2004. So finally, after everything else failed, then they said, okay, we're going to have elections. And then what happened? These people, these Shiite religious parties that they had tried so hard to avoid putting in power, got legitimately elected by the people of Iraq, along with Kurdish leaders who have the support of the Kurdish people, which, even though the Kurds are friendly to the occupation at this time, they have their own long-term goals that are different from the U.S. military's long-term goals. And we need to let go of this idea that we should decide what happens in Iraq. The Bush administration needs to give up this notion that we can play kingmaker there. At a certain point, you know, it's their country. I mean, people are not unaware of the fact that Saddam Hussein was backed by the U.S. military for most of his rule. But they nonetheless, they wanted to get rid of him, and they were willing to be pragmatic and say, like, okay, maybe it takes America to get rid of him. But at this point, you know, they're aware of the fact that America might be trying to put in a new Saddam. That's what they saw in Alawi, a new Saddam, a former Ba'athist, a former CIA agent, maybe another Saddam. That's why the new elected Iraqi government has purged all of his people. All the people that Alawi put in have been purged by the new elected Iraqi government, which made the Bush administration very unhappy.
In all your time spent in Iraq, were you able to speak with very many women?
No. No, I mean, that's a weakness of my reporting. I mean, there are women that I spoke to, but it's very difficult. It's a very conservative culture, and it's very difficult for a foreign journalist to really have honest conversations with women. Most of the conversations that with women that I had were in the presence of men. So even though I may have been speaking to a woman, they may have known what to say with their husband around. Life for women is more difficult than it was under Saddam because it's unsafe. There's a whole debate raging now in the press in this country. Now that these Islamic fundamentalists have been elected, maybe America needs to do something to keep them from imposing Sharia law. The new Islamists that have been elected, they want to make Islamic family law the law of the land in terms of the civil code and get rid of Iraq's secular family law. the fact of the matter is that even though that's an important issue, the most important issue for women, I believe, in Iraq now is security. I mean, they cannot send their children to school. They cannot go to work. People used to have jobs. I interviewed nurses. They were at home. I interviewed other nurses that were, you know, about to stop going to work. That's the most disempowering thing. People are staying home and not involving themselves in society because they're afraid. And that disproportionately affects women.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that female foreign journalists have had a more successful time of being able to reach the women there?
Somewhat, but actually less than you might think. You know, I think it's still outsider coming into a community, even a female, even to some extent foreign Arab journalists. It's a challenge, you know. I mean, like, for example, some of my good friends in Iraq who are men, I barely met their wives, you know. They would bring out food and go back into the kitchen, and I didn't have the opportunity to come to know them because they were being kept from me. And my general observation is that female journalists experience some of that same treatment as outsiders. And I have a colleague who I was actually not there at the same time. We would alternate, but Fariba Nawa, who's an Afghan-American journalist who lives in Kabul now, and she was telling me that she thought that being a Muslim woman, that she would have had more access, because in Afghanistan, actually, she found that that was actually very helpful and that she was able to do a lot of stories, but that in Iraq, you know, she was still perceived as an outsider and she wasn't able to get that same kind of work. A lot of the reporting that I did that's in the book, I did with Unji Kang, who's a female journalist from Korea, and she was wearing the hijab as a security issue in Iraq, and she did not have greater access than I did. The story that I think is most important that people fully appreciate is what the bombing of Fallujah in April of 2004 was like. And of course, America has bombed Fallujah again in November of 2004 after the election, something that was supported by both Bush and Kerry. But I think that the bombing in April is the more important one because it was the first one, and it was the first time that people in Iraq really saw what America was up to in a big way.
For many Iraqis, the moment of support for the resistance came in April, when the U.S. military invaded Fallujah, a Sunni city of 200,000 on the banks of the Euphrates River, west of Baghdad. For 25 days, the United States Marine Corps bombarded the city, killing at least 600 civilians, wounding thousands, and turning tens of thousands of Fallujans into refugees in their own country. The stated goal was to apprehend resistance fighters who killed four American mercenaries and hung their dead and burning carcasses on the old bridge in the center of town. Those villagers were never apprehended. 11-year-old Yusuf Fakhri Amash escaped Fallujah with his family, but not before the U.S. military killed his best friend.
Ahmed, Safi, Azam, Randi, John Rogafit, Al-Hayat, my little day I bought.
Ahmed was in my class. He was younger than me. He was standing next to the wall of the secondary school. He was trying to cross the road and he was hit by a bullet. The American troops fired the bullet. Americans shoot us on the street. They even bombed our school. We are innocent kids. We can't play on the streets because of the Americans.
This footage was taken by independent filmmaker Julia Guest, one of the few Western journalists who gained access to Fallujah during the American bombardment. She accompanied a team bringing medical supplies into Fallujah during a ceasefire. The picture accompanying these sounds is of an old woman in a hospital bed, a U.S. Marine's sniper bullet in her neck. Clinic director Meki Alazar.
They say there is a ceasefire. They said 12 o'clock, people went out to do some shopping. Everybody who went out was shot, and this place was full, and half of them were dead.
Julia Guest describes another elderly woman shot by American snipers during a ceasefire.
When I arrived, I found a woman who I think was in her 70s who had decided to try and help her sons get out of the city. They decided to leave as a family group. And so she'd just taken the decision to walk out of her front door waving a white flag because they knew they were in a very heavily... There was a lot of shooting in their area. And she was shot in the stomach and the foot.
Filmmaker Julia Guest says the clinic's ambulance was shot twice by American snipers, also during the ceasefire. The second time the ambulance was shot, it was carrying American and British citizens who had negotiated an agreement with the Marines to rescue the injured from an area with heavy U.S. sniper fire.
Now, it has blue sirens. It was donated from the Kingdom of Spain. It's very clearly an ambulance. It's carrying oxygen bottles. And the damage to the ambulance was such that two of the wheels are totally wrecked on it now as well. So they were left without an ambulance after that.
After 25 days of siege, the U.S. military stopped attacking Fallujah, allowing locals to begin burying their dead.
I had been going out every day, as I said, like talking to people in the community. I mean, I was in Baghdad at that time, and suddenly when this bombing of Fallujah started, it became impossible, almost overnight, to go outside. And so at first people were coming to my apartment where I was staying, you know, and a man came and he had been shot below his collarbone as he went out to get food aid from a neighborhood mosque. He told me that American snipers were shooting at the neck. And a foreign journalist, a British journalist, came by, and an Iraqi doctor came by who had been working in Fallujah, and they told me about how the Americans were shooting ambulances and that the municipal football stadium had to be turned into a graveyard because so many people had been killed by the U.S. military. And I watched on Al Jazeera, and I saw an old 73-year-old woman with a bullet in her neck, and the Jazeera correspondents who were broadcasting live from the hospital were talking about how most of the people killed were women and children, and that many had been shot in the neck by U.S. military snipers. I went out to West Baghdad near the Umm al-Qura Mosque, and I was interviewing refugees, and I interviewed a 12-year-old boy who told me that his 11-year-old best friend was shot by an American sniper as he stood outside the door of his school. To some extent, I thought that everyone must be exaggerating who is telling me these stories, that these stories were so grotesque that they couldn't possibly be completely true. But then I went to Fallujah after the bombing stopped, and I saw that whole streets were destroyed. I saw it with my own eyes, and even though I had seen it on TV, it was different to see shopping centers that had collapsed and whole rows of houses that were gone and pillows in the middle of the street. I saw the teddy bears in the middle of the street and mosques that had been bombed by giant daisy cutter bombs so that they had been turned into giant pools of water, you know, and sewage. And just how whole sections of the city have been turned into a ghost town. And the thing that most sticks out for me, in addition to seeing the football stadium that had been turned into a graveyard, is I watched this medical team pull a rotting corpse of a middle-aged woman out of a front yard of a neighbor's house. And she had been trying to flee the city in her car when it was bombed, because the Americans were bombing anything that moved. And her car was still there, and you could see it. Her neighbor was telling me that he courageously went out and ripped her out of the car after the bombing, which was not safe at all because the Americans were shooting at everything, but he thought it was important, and he went out and he got her body and he buried it temporarily in the front yard of his house. And watching the medical team pull her out of the ground in front of the house and load her onto a flatbed truck, and watching the eyes of this like 12 or 13-year-old boy who was wearing a surgical mask and part of the medical team, as, you know, they poured formaldehyde onto her body and took her away to the football stadium to be buried. You know, America did this. And this is mostly what America is doing in Iraq now. Thank you. people have very little interaction with the Americans now. As I said, the Americans are very distant. When their Humvee breaks down, they close the road. They come in through neighborhoods on patrols in tanks, you know, but they don't talk to people. I think that people don't understand. People have no explanation. The explanations that tend to come are conspiracy explanations. The country is controlled by Jews. America is controlled by Jews, and therefore they want Israel to control the whole Middle East. These are the kind of crazy explanations that people are being pushed towards. The kind of fundamentalist preachers' ideas getting out there and being more accepted by people as they grasp for any explanation for this kind of brutality. I mean, these are the kind of things that people say. People believe that America is like the car bombings that are killing innocent civilians that you see on the news all the time. I mean, to a certain extent, they're targeting the police and the new Iraqi army. To a certain extent, people believe that this is all being instigated by the United States as a reason to stay, because the only reason that America has to stay is to stabilize the situation. So they figure that as long as the situation remains unstable, you know, this is a conspiracy theory that's been building in terms of people believing it. Why would people trust the U.S. military? I mean, George Bush is blaming everything on Zarqawi. I mean, like, Iraqi people are not stupid. They know that one man cannot be doing so many things. He's not this kind of, like, omnipotent Svengali figure, you know, that there's something going on that's more complicated. And then the absence of information, they can come up with whatever theory best suits their own imagination. What I tried to do in my book, I don't know to the extent that other people, you know, did this in their work, but, you know, introducing Muqtada Sadr as a political figure, one of the things that the book affords you to do that a nightly news report does not is you can talk about, like, who is Muqtada Sadr? What is his family's history? You know, where does he come from? You know, what about Ibrahim al-Jafari, the new prime minister? Oh, he was opposing Saddam with Muqtada Sadr's uncle in 1979, you know, and they were trying to emulate the Iranian revolution that brought Khomeini to power together in Iraq, and that's why America supported Saddam Hussein to kill Muqtada Sadr's uncle and exile Ibrahim al-Jafari. And oh, by the way, you know, during those 10 years, Ibrahim al-Jafari, the new prime minister, was launching, you know, attacks, you know, across the border. And like somebody like Jalal Talabani, the new president, you know, I try to give background on him, you know, oh, during the 80s, you know, oh, the reason that Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurds at Halabja was because Jalal Talabani was collaborating with the Iranian army against Saddam for Kurdish autonomy, and it was part of the Iran-Iraq war, and that's why America helped Saddam gas the Kurds.
Where did you learn this history?
I don't think that I can point and say, go here. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that people have to generally educate themselves and seek out a variety of sources. It's not really a good one-stop shopping, and a lot of it does come from being on the ground in the region, getting people's personal stories. So that's why I say the general thing is the information is out there now, you know, and you can go get it, but, you know, you can't say, oh, you know, go here. It's too diffuse. You really have to kind of dedicate yourself to it for a little while. I tried to wake up in the morning. I was staying, when I first got there, I was staying with two other foreign journalists at the Beit al-Dulaymi in South Baghdad. It's a furnished apartment building. It's owned by the Dulaymi family, which is also prominent in the resistance, although not all Dulaymis. At that time, there was mostly Iraqi honeymooners living there. Gradually, the ownership realized that they could make more money off of foreign journalists, and then the building started to fill up with foreign journalists. One of the reasons that it was nice to live there was because they wouldn't allow mercenaries or foreign contractors to live there, and they were very careful about who they allowed to live there, which kept it from being a resistance target for the most part. So after I would have a relationship with some translators, all I would do is either they would come over to meet me or I would take a taxi to their house and we would have breakfast together and we would talk about the story that we were going to do that day. We would try to mix up between going to offices of Iraqi politicians from different groups and going to talk to people on the street, going to visit hospitals or whatever our business was. We'd do that until about 3 p.m. From like 3 until 5, we would do literal translations of the things that, you know, we really need to do a good job on. At a certain point, which was roughly correlated actually to the time where it became really unsafe to go outside, the Dulemi building was wired for the internet, which was nice, because that was actually one of the most dangerous things that I did, was I had to go out into an internet cafe at like 9 p.m. when it was really unsafe outside to file my story. And that was actually the time where I most feared for my life, because I was out alone at night in Baghdad. But then eventually the building itself, since there were so many journalists living there, was wired for the internet. And then I was not unlike filing stories from anywhere else. Then as time went on, it became more difficult, you know, to do that kind of work. And that's when I decided I didn't want to be in Baghdad anymore. After America attacked Fallujah, I couldn't work that way anymore. It was not safe, you know, and I didn't want to go in bed with the American army. And I didn't want to have to only believe the people who came to meet me at my hotel room, which is what I think a lot of journalists who are still in Baghdad moved into highly fortified hotels, and they do try to talk to people. I mean, they are trying to do a good job, but it's just not safe for them to go outside, so they can only interview people who come to them. So it's difficult to ascertain whether or not people are telling you the truth. Plus, it was very difficult for me emotionally. I didn't feel physically threatened. The only time anyone ever pointed a gun at me was a couple of times when American soldiers pointed guns at me. But I was not holding up very well emotionally, dealing with the constant pain that I was having to see. And it's not just having to see it, but, you know, you go and you interview people and they talk about how their relatives are in prison or how they've been killed, and you see dead bodies and you see cemeteries. And then you have to go home and you have to log the tape. You have to listen to the tape and you have to transcribe it. And then you have to write your story. And then you have to read your story after you get an edit. Then you have to mix your story. And so I was working, you know, until 11 o'clock at night, every night. And I was having to relive the experiences again and again, which did not bode well for when I would go to sleep. Other reporters were dealing with it much better, I think, because they are experienced war reporters and they've developed this kind of cynicism about the world that allows them to let some of these things roll off them a little bit easier. But I didn't want to develop that cynicism. You know, I wanted to keep it as real as possible. And that became very difficult emotionally after a while, to keep my humanity and to keep my sanity at the same time. I had the opportunity to write this book, and I'm trying to go around talking about it because I think it is an important story. I called the book How America Lost Iraq partially because I think that the story is over in a way. Now we're just in this like terrible fallout from the story. And so in a way, it's more important to be here talking to folks about it than it is to be there getting shot at. And then in the fall, I'm getting married. People ask me, like, how can you write a book and call it How America Lost Iraq? Like, it's still going on. How can you say that we lost? How can you say that there's nothing positive we can do? And I just like to say that nothing positive is being done by the U.S. military in Iraq at all. There is nothing good at all. There are no positive ancillary byproducts. Like, Saddam Hussein is gone, and he's been gone for a long time. and we're not rebuilding the country, and it's impossible for us to rebuild the country. There may have been a time early on, you know, some people say, well, we owe it to them to rebuild the electricity. We cannot. It is impossible now for us to rebuild the electricity in Iraq. The electricity is part of the war. The resistance is targeting the electricity because the lack of electricity is an embarrassment to the Americans and the elected Iraqi government. The only way that the elected Iraqi government will be able to rebuild the electricity is if the U.S. military leaves and the electricity is no longer part of the armed conflict. And you see it, too, in the American troops over there. You know, I didn't have a lot of contact with the American troops, actually. But sometimes I would have an interaction here or there. I went to the gates of Abu Ghraib and was interviewing families outside, and I wanted to talk to some responsible American person. I just talked to the corporal who was standing outside of the gates of Abu Ghraib guarding it, and I said, who do I talk to who's important? And he gave me a name, and he told me to go to Camp Victory, which is this military base that used to be called Saddam Hussein International Airport. Now it's called Camp Victory. He said, I'm just a corporal. I don't know anything. You know, this country is all effed up. You know, if these people don't want to be free, then we shouldn't be here. That's his take. He's not seeing the other side of his gun. But even he realizes that there's something not quite right going on. And he doesn't seem like he wants to be in the middle of it. Sometimes you just lose and you need to admit defeat and come home.
And you've been listening to Circle A Radio here on KBOO 90.7 FM. You can email Circle A Radio at info@circlearadio.org, or you can check us out for more information on the web at circlearadio.org. Tune in to our next show on Wednesday, July 6th at 6 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.